Good afternoon, for those of you in London and around the world, in fact. My name is Professor Chris Alden. I'm one of the directors of the LSE Ideas, which is a foreign policy think tank based here at the LSE. Today, we're going to be hosting Dr. Ahmed Shinak, who will speak to us on the quest on cyber policy in the Middle East. He is what he is presenting on will fit into our larger digital IR program, which is a project that examines the consequences, concerns, and the relationship between the emerging digital technology and that world with the international relations theoretical underpinnings of our particular discipline. So, as you know, cyber issues are of considerable concern around the world, and in particular, one area of particular focus is in the Middle East. What our speaker today will address will be how cyber conflicts, cyber weapons, and the forging of policy and politics in the Middle East affect and play out in the region. So we'll focus on origins and trends. If I can just introduce him more formally. Dr. Shinak is a postdoctoral research fellow at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, the Fenderman School of Public Policy and Government, and a research fellow at Hebrew University's Cybersecurity Research Center, the Davis Institute for International Relations, and the Truman Institute for Advancements of Peace. He's served and worked in the cybersecurity sector with the Israeli Ministry of Defense, and holds a political science degree, an MA and a PhD in political science from Hebrew University, as well as the done postdoc work at Harvard University. Lots of other things he's done. I'm sure he can speak to those. Dr. Ahmed Shinak, over to you.
Hi, and I want to start by thanking LSEIDs for inviting me and for giving me this opportunity to speak to you all. Thank you for the wonderful presentation. I am at the Hebrew University at the time. My research in general, and I'll try to show that in my presentation, focus on the intersection between emerging and disruptive technologies, or mainly cybersecurity, but also others, and the forging of security policy. I am researching also the effect, dual effect between interstate and intrastate relationships in this situation, and also other political and social contexts. Some of the work that I do also is regarding processes of innovation, and I'll try to address that during the talk. What I'll do today is start with some context and basic assumptions, which I think are very needed when talking about the Middle East and cybersecurity. I will later try to do something which is, an attempt to present a kind of a menu of potential issues, important issues, according to the way I see it, in regards to cybersecurity and the political situation, the political status in the Middle East. I will give a few examples for each. Of course, there are many more, and hopefully this will give you some kind of a balanced picture in a way, which is supposed to be an opening for more research, more talk, more conversation. Each of these topics can hold a whole presentation by itself, if not more. But I thought that trying to give the big picture here, touching only on the glimpse of things, is important. The first element, the first important basic assumption is that the Middle East is definitely on the map in terms of cybersecurity. According to one of the main researchers that was done about cybersecurity by Valignano and Manis, who were looking at all the known cyber attacks, cyber conflicts until 2014, one of the main conclusion is that there's an overlap between where there is an existing conflict a political conflict interstate or between states in the world, and also cyber conflict. Cyber conflict does not just exist by themselves. They tend to overlap. And hence, the Middle East, as you can see in this map, which is provided by the National Security Archive, is very much existent there. Just, but the general world map of cyber conflict, if you look at it, you will see many states and other organizations which are active there. In a way, they have a much bigger role in cybersecurity than other areas of the world. So it's definitely something that should be investigated. Cyber is also, countries in the Middle East are also victims of cyber attacks. As you can see in one of the latest overviews, it is also a place in which a lot of attacks occur. A lot of this, states in the Middle East are victims of cyber attacks, whether they are also initiating cyber attacks by themselves, but also they very much feel or experience cyber as something that affects their perception of security. And hence it necessitates, the creation of policy, the initiation, the creation of institutions and so forth. One of the major things that I'll try to show today is the overlap between the existing social and political, context and tensions in the Middle East and cyber attacks. Just a few pictures here can show you that many of the things that happens anyhow overlaps with cybersecurity. It was stated by one of the main researchers about what is one of the main issues in cybersecurity, which is the attribution problem, the fact that it's almost impossible to fully 100% attribute a cyber attack to an entity, to a state, that it's always a political choice. It is always a political choice in the cyber world to decide, to say, to announce that a cyber attack was done by a certain entity, by a state or by an organization. And hence, this is a political story, and that's the kind of story that I will try to present. Something to say about the research, which is about cybersecurity. It is definitely not there enough. There's a growing amount of research, researchers that are working on the intersection of Middle East and cybersecurity, but there's a lot to be done yet. Some of the special issues that happens in the Middle East, like the power of sub-states, entities like, terrorist organizations and others, it's one of those things that are not really investigated well in among cyber researchers. There's also a lack of the study of cyber from the local perspective. Nobody hardly reads whatever is written in Arabic, in Farsi, in Turkish, in Hebrew, maybe a bit more, but not enough about how cybersecurity, cyber issues affect the perception of security in those states and the creation of cyber policies. In a way, we tend, or among this growing field of research of cybersecurity, there's a tendency to rely on a Western kind of like approach in which we measure the effect of cyber in the Middle East and how it affects the Western world and not how it affects actually in the Middle East. A slide here shows one of the famous examples for that, which was a simple attack that was done by the Syrian Electronic Army, a pretty small cyber arm of Syria. Sorry. The attack wasn't really serious. They were hacking Twitter and saying that there was an explosion in the White House. This was very fast presented as a false or fake news, but the effect at the time of 2013 on the stock market was very big. And that's an example how a very minor event in terms of the history of cyber in the Middle East was treated as a pretty big event in the West or in the United States. Sorry again. Okay, this is the menu of what I'll try to present today. I'll try to discuss a few things like how cyber is an issue of the relationship between the Middle East and great powers, great important countries in the world, how it's part of local regime stability, of cyber power as it's translated into innovation and the ability to have a successful ecosystem for innovative cyber tools, how regional dynamics, whether aspiration for hegemony or anything else, can be seen also expressed in cyber conflict, and also the relationship between states and sub-state actors. I'll start with how great power are seen in the Middle East in terms of cybersecurity. First of all, cyber is not just an issue of attacks and conflict. It's also based on, you know, the basic ability to advance infrastructure, IT infrastructure. And the Middle East is definitely part of a bigger picture, part of a bigger game, a bigger competition, technological competition between the leading powers of the world, mostly the United States and China. Talking about the 5G, for example, the new generation for the IT infrastructure, the growing competition between the ability of China to provide 5G cheap and very good and well and efficient 5G infrastructure by their companies like Huawei and ZTE, and also counter actions like the Clean Network Initiative by the United States. The Middle East is part of that, convincing states today in the world, but also in the Middle East, to either refrain from allowing Huawei or China to provide them with a cybersecurity, or not cyber, with a 5G infrastructure, or to adopt that Chinese technology, is really in a way it's almost symbolizing as if you're choosing sides politically. Which camp are you siding with? And the Middle East is definitely a part of this big game. Also, as the Middle East, always in history, geostrategically located between Europe and the Far East or Asia and Africa, it is also a critical place for the infrastructure of optic fiber, whether under sea cables or above ground. Also part of the Chinese aspiration, their big plan for the Belt and Road Initiative that has a digital component to it. We can see that the fact that these have, in a way, along the years, have made some states, like Egypt, for example, very important as a location for undersea and also overland major communication cables. And today, there's new initiatives like the Blue Raman Initiative. This means that those infrastructure makes, on the one side, those countries important. It's like a natural resource that can be utilized for, you know, to gain political power, but also it's a cause for fear and it's a vulnerability, need to be protected. And the infrastructure there holds a lot of information which is of interest, whether for intelligence organizations or other reasons around the world. There are bilateral agreements between different states and local Middle Eastern states that are focused on cyber. Cyber is one of the key issues today that are discussed when you are forging security alliances. In 2020, Iran and China signed a big security pact, which included cyber cooperation. But that's the picture in the slide. But there are, of course, a lot of ties that are held by other countries, like Israel, for example, with the United States and other countries. And it seems that those bilateral agreements, which are today also about cyber, are a big portion of the security relationship between Middle Eastern countries and countries outside of the Middle East. Middle Eastern countries also pose a threat to other countries, to great powers, of the leading countries in the world. This is a quote, for example, that you've seen here, one of the main spokesmen in Iran from 2012 already, in which Iran, after revealing she was attacked by cyber means, have decided to plan a retaliation, or to create the ability to retaliate or to become a cyber power. And as you can see on the slide, this is one of the latest exposures in the United States of an attack allegedly was came from Iran against trying to meddle through a cyber operation with the latest United States presidential election. And just to see that, you know, the Middle East plays a factor when assessing threat in regards to the cyber realm. It's true also, of course, to other states, not just to Iran. This is an example. Already in 1998, one of the first events that was served as a wake-up call in the United States was the event that was called the Solar Sunrise, which was when the United States revealed she was attacked through the internet. Sensitive places like the Pentagon and NASA were hacked. When digging into the event, first people at the Pentagon thought, you know, they were attacked by Iraq at the time under the regime of Saddam Hussein. But then later they revealed this was the cause of a young teenager from Israel that was collaborating with two other American teenagers, doing that just for the fun of it, just to show how sometimes the unintended consequences of an attack. That was the first time that the Middle East came on the map of cyber, at the beginning of cybersecurity. As you can see also, Middle Eastern countries are also victims, but also the initiators, or considered to be the initiators of a lot of cyber network espionage, you know, the stealing of intellectual property by cyber attacks. And this is definitely a place that is both causing problem, but also on the defense. Moving ahead, I want to talk about one of the main issues, which is, you know, which regards to cyber and in the Middle East. The fact that the Middle East is composed of a lot of states which are of more of autocratic nature, or not really democracies, just like in other places in the world, makes regime stability one of the main fears which is associated with cyber. One of the main events which had, an international importance, of course, was the Arab Spring, or the Tahrir Revolution of 2011. At the time, it created an image as if this was a revolution that was based on social media as a tool to maneuver people to the street, to be able to topple the regime or create instability in the former regimes in Egypt and other states. Even though later investigation and research have shown that a lot of the movements was actually dependent on the very traditional Islamic social kind of abilities to maneuver people into the street, not really based on social media, but still this has caused an image that social media or the internet is posing a threat to regime stability. We can see this effect in this example here, which is how the new constitutions of states in the Middle East, like the new constitution of 2014 in Egypt, have addressed this issue. Security of information, or the sovereignty of information, as a key issue that is enacted into a constitution that gives the states a right to control social media. Social media as a place which should be monitored and also feared. This is true, of course, not just to the Arab Spring, but also to other events which were about regime stability in the Middle East, whether Iran in 2009 and also lately in the fuel protests, Syria and the civil war. And one of the main tools that are being used, which is an internal tool, but it's still in the realm of cybersecurity, is internet shutdowns, the ability of the regime to shut down the internet in order to prevent the use of social media or IT in order to undermine the regime's authority. And I think this is a very important issue. It's important because we tend to think of cybersecurity mainly as, cyber conflict between states, between Israel and Iran, between countries in the Middle East and other countries in the world. But for most Middle Eastern states, the main issue is internal stability and how it's associated with cyber. Of course, with the need to keep having the internet as a key to develop the economy and stuff like that. This is also a tool of social media and regime stability. It's also not just an internal tool, but also a tool used by states against each other. This is an example of an alleged attack by a Saudi hacker, creating false or propaganda inside the Lebanese social media, you know, meddle with the political situation in Lebanon. And as you can see here, by words of the chairman of the Hezbollah organization, Hassan Nasrallah, talking about how social media is a place for the actions of electronic armies, as if this is an arena manipulated by other forces that are trying to meddle, whether in Lebanon or undermining the Islamic Revolution. And Hassan Nasrallah's lectures or speeches are one of the main places to look for in order to understand, you know, the Lebanese arena. And this social media takes a bigger and a bigger space in his talk. When talking about cyber power, one tend to think about cyber conflict, but cyber power of states is also based upon the ability of state to innovate, to be at the leading front of the technology, the ability to create new innovative cyber tools, whether for defense or offense or anything else. One of the main examples is, of course, Israel. This is Israel today has won, is, you know, for 2020 received 30% of all venture capital that was invested in cyber in the world, 30%, second only to the United States. It has a flourishing ecosystem that connects between different needed stakeholders like universities, investors from around the world, big international corporations, local startups, local companies, and also the security sector and the government. This is a very, in the slides here, you can see a vivid example of how Israel took steps in order to encourage the creation of this ecosystem, understanding that the creation of a thriving innovation cyber ecosystem will eventually shift Israel to become a cyber power in the world. This is the picture from the Be'er Sheva Cyber Park. As you can see, the former Minister of Defense of Israel, Bogi Yaalon, talking about this park, which is connecting between the IDF, the Israeli military's cyber units, the Ben-Gurion University, local startups and firms, investors, international corporations, as an example of how you utilize this effect in order to advance a country's standing. Of course, this is not happening just inside a country. And of course, it happens in other countries as well. It's also about maybe the creation of a regional ecosystem between states in the Middle East. You can see this definitely as one of the pivotal issues in the relationship between Israel and the UAE, or Israel and the Gulf states, which is thriving under the Abraham Accords, the ability to, whether commercially or also in terms of security, to develop ties which are about innovation, which are about cybersecurity, is definitely something which is on the front. The downside of it, of course, is that the Middle East, especially Israel, with this growing amount of cyber companies, are also selling cyber abilities to many states, some of which use those abilities in the wrong way, creating human rights violations and stuff like that. The NSO group is a famous group that was exposed lately, and this is how the Middle East is incentivizing, in a way, the creation of an international cyber arms control regime, in a sense, because a place which has a lot of friction, a lot of action, a lot of companies, eventually, also is encouraging, or maybe also for the better, the creation of some kind of order in regards to selling cyber tools. Of course, one of the main things is the overlap between internal actions in the Middle East, internal friction and dynamics, and how they are emanating into the cyber world. I will discuss just a few, but there are many more. The most famous one is, of course, the overlap between the aspiration of Iran to gain nuclear abilities, and how during the quest of the Western countries, allegedly Israel and the United States, were using cyber tools in order to attack Iran, some of Iran's uranium enrichment facilities, using the Stuxnet malware to what later was exposed as the Olympic Games operation. I think the importance of this event, which is far-reaching, far greater than the actual action that it, the actual harm that it inflicted upon Iran. The fact that it was exposed in the New York Times, the fact that books were written about that, have really pushed ahead, pushed towards the, to the focus of the world, the use of, cyber means as a way to advance national security interests. And the question should be asked, why is that happening mainly in the Middle East? So because of issues in the Middle East, maybe the Middle East is such a, a very conflictual, a place that has a lot of conflict anyway, a lot of conflict, a lot of friction. You would also see a lot of conflict and friction in terms of cyber. So it pushes to the greater international public view issues of cybersecurity. Stuxnet, when it was exposed, really pushed ahead the understanding among people in the world that states can craft cyber weapons, cyber abilities, and it's really part of the new game, the new international game in a way. Of course, one of the other issues, which are about the internal, Middle Eastern dynamics and cyber, is about the quest for hegemony, mainly today between Iran and Israel. There's a chain of attacks, a change of actions, which should be addressed in a bit, on both sides. What is interesting is one that those actions, although very severe, like the attack on Iran's main ports, or the attack against Israel, some of Israel's water facilities, are also considered to be actions that are under the threshold, under the threshold of war. Hence, those tools are considered to be the kind of tools that can you can inflict harm upon another state. Also giving you the ability to of deniability, and not causing a retaliation that would that would escalate towards a full war or a physical kinetic conflict. Another feature was interesting about those actions is that it's almost like it is signaling between the states. There's a tendency to also have some kind of public side to the attack. For example, one of the attacks was changing the wording on electronic billboards in Tehran, in Iran, talking about trying to stir political riots in Iran, talking about trying to say Khamenei, where's our gas and stuff like that, or messages that appeared on fuel stations, fuel pump screens. So it's almost like there's a need or a tendency or a will to convey a message using those attacks. Another feature of those attacks, which is interesting, is that those attacks are changing. And today, some of the attacks, especially the last Iranian attacks, are attributed not to the Iranian military or Ministry of Intelligence, but to Iranian groups of criminal groups, working either by themselves or as proxies, It's also, it seems that it's migrated towards actions or attacks of ransomware, like the last ransomware attack by our Iranian criminal groups that attacked one of the Israel's main hospitals, the Hillel Yafe Hospital, paralyzing it. So it seems that it, you know, this dynamic shifted and evolved, that it becomes much more elusive today, somewhere between criminal activities and state sponsor activities, something that provides deniability, but also convey a message, a mixed picture there that is considered by some as an elegant way of a conflict, because there's no real war, nobody's dying, not yet, or as a very dangerous action that might escalate the entire arena towards towards war. Another big issue that is hardly addressed is cyber and cyber state actors. It seems that in the Middle East, this is a very thriving issue, very differently from other places in the world in which terrorist organizations are not hardly on the capacity of inflicting harm, serious harm through cyber. This is one of the examples used by Hamas, who controls the Gaza Strip against Israel. Although not very technically advanced, they enjoy what is a very critical issue in the cyber world, which is social knowledge about Israelis. The fact that many Hamas people have spent a lot of time in Israeli jails, they know Hebrew, they know the slang, they know how to design fake apps to draw soldiers to click on the wrong link, and eventually to provide Hamas information. This was a dating app, a fake dating app that was created by Hamas, in which they conversed with soldiers serving on the border of the Gaza Strip. In a way, this is showing really the essence of, you know, the asymmetric essence of cyber, which is not always exist. So sometimes in order to create serious malware like StockNext, you need really national resources. But this is another example how you can utilize social knowledge, which is sometimes exists among those organizations, in order to utilize it for, you know, in the relationship with the friction between states and sub-state actors. In one of the latest conflict between Hamas in Gaza and Israel, one of the latest skirmish, another occurrence occurred, which is important to indicate. It was a cross-domain attack. Thus, Israel retaliated to a cyber attack that was done by Hamas, an unsuccessful attack, by kinetically attacking with missiles the Hamas cyber headquarters, and also announcing that to the world. In a way, this is one of the only known attacks which are cross domain, in which you are using kinetic means in order to retaliate to a cyber attack, not answering cyber with cyber. And maybe here there's also a message to the world in terms of norms. Maybe this is the ability to do so is also because this is it's not a state, by an entity or sub-state entity that is controlling Gaza, and hence you can do that without getting punished by the world. Another example is for the utilize of social media by terrorist organizations like Hezbollah, utilizing the fact that open societies, whether democracies or, you know, other societies that have thriving social media, are open to influence operations using cyber attacks. And this was expressed by Hezbollah in many times, and there's various examples for that. Last but not least is the case of Joint Task Force ARIS, which was a joint task force by the United States and the UK against ISIS at the time. Another example of how the utilization of social media at the time, ISIS was using social media to send those horrific films, creating fear, really empowering the organization in order to stir counteraction by states. And eventually it was also a lot of kinetic attacks are against those few operatives that were actually, making this the ISIS operation in the social media active. to conclude, and hopefully I was not extending the time that was provided to me, the Middle East is a place that has a lot of friction, a lot of conflict. And therefore, it has also an overlap between those conflicts, between those issues, those security issues, through the cyber realm as well. I think there are a few main issues that is that are affected because of that. One is the effect of cyber conflicts in the Middle East on norms, whether through issues of critical infrastructures, as we can see today, for example, the attack on Israel water supply or the attack of on Iranian ports. It seems that are pushing to the edge the thought of using cyber attacks in order to inflict harm on critical national critical infrastructure. This is a main issue for many states, but in other states, this is only theoretical. And here, it already happened. There's also norms that are regarding cyber terrorism or the use of cyber by proxies. It makes you think whether the examples that we see in the Middle East of retaliating across domain using kinetic means in order to retaliate to a cyber attack, which is done by terrorist organizations, is maybe setting a norm. This is acceptable because this is terrorist organizations are considered not legitimate. And also cases of information sovereignty, an issue which is pushed by many autocratic regimes in the world, also very much exist inside the many autocratic regimes in the Middle East. There's a tendency to see the Middle East as a laboratory, as a place that, because of its constant friction and conflict, really tests weapons, how they get accepted, how they affect both in terms of security-wise, but also socially. And this is also why we have a lot of bilateral agreements between great powers of the world and local regimes, local Middle Eastern regimes that have cyber abilities. It is also why, maybe one of the reasons why there's a thriving cyber innovation ecosystem in the Middle East, whether in the Gulf states or in Israel, also in Iran in a way, because they're using those means very much more than they would use it in other places. This would be a true argument also for other weapons which are not in the cyber, in the physical world. It seems that in terms of affecting the state themselves, there's a lot of effect on the institutions that are being created in the Middle East countries in regard to cyber or internet security. There's a growing legal framework here, whether the new constitutions post the Arab Spring or in just in Israel and other places. There's a growing amount of military branches, intelligence units, and law enforcement agencies which are in a process of force buildup in regard to cybersecurity in the Middle East. It becomes a much more prominent issue. I would conclude by saying this could have been a lecture also about another security issue in this Middle East. But it seems that cyber today is taking much more space in the Middle East. So a lot of the pre-existing presumptions about the Middle East also exist in regard to cyber. Thank you. And hopefully there will be some interesting questions.
Great. Thank you very much. Fascinating talk and one that I think gives us insight. I particularly like your comment about the idea of the Middle East serving as a laboratory for some of these techniques, some of the weaponry, because I think in the Cold War era, there was very much that at play. So this is an extension of that kind of logic to the present day. While people are thinking of questions, I actually have four questions, and I'm not going to ask four questions, but I'll ask one of them with respect to asymmetrical warfare and asymmetrical positioning. Maybe warfare is not the full range here. You gave the example of both sub-state actors and indeed even teenagers being able to take actions which had impact at a state level. Is there Is this level of asymmetrical positioning, is this sustainable? Does the logic of great power, resources, and ultimately going to prevail so that smaller actors, which we always hear about as being as having a disruptive effect on great power infrastructure or penetrating in, you know, into Pentagon, let's say, or these sort of places. Is that logic a temporary one that ultimately big states will be able to meaningfully rebalance the asymmetry there?
Well, I think there was a tendency to think of cyber or using the internet as a mean to advance asymmetric warfare, as a tool that will empower small power states or states that have less, that are not that advanced in technology. I'm not sure this is true anymore. Actually, I don't think it's true. I think there's an overlap between the different clubs. I mean, if you would think about that, there's an overlap between advanced technological countries, the kind that would have nuclear abilities or the ability to utilize natural resources in order to advance a nuclear project, whether they already have nuclear weapons or they're on the way there or have the ability to do so, and the ability to advance cyber abilities. There's almost an overlap between the clubs in a way. If the Sputnik's example is an example for something, it's an example of how much time and resources it takes to really create an advanced, sophisticated malware. This is not to say that we should not think of cyber as a space, as another social political space in which all kinds of interaction occur. Some of them are the kind of interactions which are about also sub-state entities, whether criminal organizations, proxies, or terrorist organizations. They're also active there as well. The way I see it, it seems that they have the power to utilize cyber in a different way. Whether it's utilizing economical incentives like a ransom that overlaps with national interests, okay? You don't really know. Is your hospital being attacked because of a national interest of another country, or is it attacked solely for, to pay money as a ransom? And this really gives, those entities, it empowers them to serve as tools who encourage or give deniability to states. Or they're utilizing the kind of tactic knowledge, like social knowledge, that in the example of Hamas, that really gives them the ability to use even, I would say, low-tech cyber attacks with fake apps and stuff like that. But eventually they can be very effective. Let me give you another example. The Israeli authorities at the time, trying to encourage people to rush to shelter when there's a missile attack, also created a national app that you can download to your cell phone, and it will give you all the alerts in the right time. Hamas at the time very easily created a fake app, which was a bit the same, and also published it. So what happened was a mistrust of citizens in the application, not knowing did they downloaded the real app or the wrong one. Will it give them real indication of a missile attack or not? So this is a great example, again, of how sometimes you can use easy and low, cheap tools to create a cyber effect. But on the other hand, does not dismiss that the big things are happening by states that have very advanced technological power.
Thank you. That's very, very interesting. We have a question. I'll read out to you. How well are Western countries aware of the need to follow cybersecurity and cyber warfare developments in the Middle East? Which sectors of government recognize this and which don't or which do not? And this is Ewan Grant, London, former UK law enforcement analyst.
Thanks for the question. Great questions. I've opened by talking about research, the lack of needed research in this field. And I think this is really, really attached to this question. I think there's a tendency always in Western countries to see the Middle East through Western eyes. Well, they fail that in many different realms, also in regards to the cyber realm. I don't think there's enough understanding in investigation to the effect of cyber weapons and cyber abilities, cyber defense and offense, or this sense of insecurity, cyber insecurity that is in the Middle East, how it affects those Middle Eastern regimes' policies and their intentions. Not enough was investigated in that regard. This also necessitates to read things in Arabic, in Farsi, in Turkish, in Hebrew, and that's hard for many states, also for their intelligence community sometimes, when they have limited resources and they don't put it on that direction. They tend mostly to assess the Middle East in regard to cyber when, studying the metrics, studying cyber attacks, studying, this kind of more of like a technical information, and then look at the social and political impact. So I think this is very much needed. And hopefully academic research, which is starting there today, will start to fill in the gap.
Great, thanks. I will pose one of my quite a specific questions, and then I see others coming up. The NSO you mentioned, I think I'm right in saying that Facebook has launched a lawsuit against that. And I'm wondering, is there Israeli legislation which is also at play here that would restrict companies such as that selling security-based things to foreign, I don't know, either foreign governments or individual use or misuse of this? I'm just wondering what the legal position is.
First of all, I'll say, I think, there's a lawsuit in California against NSO by Facebook, which is the owner of WhatsApp, which was apparently one of the main apps that was used as a vulnerability in that application, was used as the mean to use NSO Pegasus cyber tool. And there are actually more lawsuits coming over by Apple and by many others. NSO, in a way, became a symbol of today of the need to create regulation that will restrict or would limit or would direct or give borders to the emerging market of offensive cyber services of different kinds. First, it should say that most cyber companies are defensive. They provide defensive abilities, whether that's active defense or passive defense, it doesn't matter. In Israel, there is actually legislation which is about arms control in general. From 2007, that legislation is with accordance with the Wassenaar Agreement, the agreement between states that is dealing with dual use technology, how it should be limited and controlled, so it's not going to be used for the purpose of inflicting harm. But this is a very much in a growing or an emerging field. Internationally, there's not really a clear regulation yet. The United States has just published a regulation just lately, last month, but also due to the NSO incident there. So I think we're on the verge of seeing this field growing and with more concrete understanding. It seems that in this case, NSO and the Middle East have served as an incentive to the creation of some kind of an international regime or the beginning of that. And this had happened before in other fields of different arms, like cluster munition and stuff like that. Also, we've seen advance in international law, which occurred because of real occurrences in the Middle East. So this is maybe another example for that.
Another example, I suppose, or a variant on the laboratory, Middle East as laboratory, in this case, in terms of norms of conduct on this. I've got a question now. How, in your opinion, would countries go about implementing cyber strategy? How have Middle East countries gone about doing so? And is there a sort of roadmap as to the kinds of things they should do first and then things that should flow from that?
Well, yeah, of course. I mean, it seems that many states today have, have published even, you know, their cyber strategies. I mean, they also have a cyber strategy with internal, but also they also published them in English. This is part of contributing to their standing as a cyber power. It's definitely something which is, it's there. It also happens in the Middle East. It's Israel just published in English their cyber strategy, their international cyber strategy. Of course, it was published before in Hebrew as an internal document. In other states in the Middle East, which are less communicative, or there is a growing process of forging cyber policies, even though they're not published into the world, I think this is one of those elements that should be investigated. Maybe with the ability to read in local languages, we could really reveal more and more cyber strategies of countries in the Middle East, understanding well, more than before, how did cyber affect, general cyber, not security policy. I would say, though, that there will be coming out a book written by James Shire, which is a former, Oxford scholar who's covering this field and is mainly dealing with cyber strategies in the Gulf states, which are much more advanced and etc., more communicative, more open to research. But this is definitely a need, and there's definitely things to be investigated.
You had mentioned something about the technologies, you know, the high-tech countries playing a particular role, states playing a particular role in cyber. I'm curious, a very media-conscious and activist country from the Middle East, the Gulf states, Qatar, to what extent does that translate into an activism in this domain, to your knowledge?
To my knowledge, I mean, the Gulf states are definitely one of the main places in which there's a growing ecosystem for cyber innovation. In general, we can say that. The leading country there is probably the UAE, which is already declared their will to push, to advance technology, to allocate resources, to advance technology that will put UAE in a bigger, higher place in the world. It's about cyber, it's also about space abilities and many others. And as I mentioned before, this is also part of the connection today under the Abraham Accords between Israel and the UAE. I mean, you have to, kind of like join hands, join their ecosystem abilities as a way to advance technology. Qatar, although a very strong in terms of media with Al Jazeera and others, has, to my knowledge, I've not publicly in a way I've addressed this issue as exposedly as the UAE and other countries. So I haven't seen any specific initiative there, even though it makes you wonder. I mean, they're very strong in terms of media, but it seems that doesn't really overlap with their creating abilities to conduct a cyber operation.
Interesting. I have a question here. Given the vulnerability of states and societies to cyber, this kind of cyber attacks you've been talking about, do you anticipate a reversal, a kind of decoupling from some elements of 5G as a security measure?
Yeah. Well, first of all, that's true. Thank you for the question. One of the things that should be developed now under 5G, I mean, 5G, we're just in the stage of implementing the basic infrastructure, which can be done only by a handful of companies. For none of them Middle Eastern, none of them also American. It's two Chinese companies and two Scandinavian. The next stage will be the development of abilities to enhance the security of communication, which will be utilized in 5G. 5G is a big step, it's a big change from previous generations of IT infrastructure. It's not like the jump between 3G and 4G. This will first allow the Internet of Things and many other stuff, but more of it, a lot of the management of the network will be based on software. So less hardware, less cables and routers, more using software to control things. This means it's more manageable, but also maybe more vulnerable. And this implies a very strong need, and the answers are not there yet technologically, to better secure 5G. It's one of the core issues for cyber innovation today is how to do that. And, you know, how to secure IoT, how to secure, you know, the ability to use without knowing the fact that your security camera is connected to the internet in order to inflict harm on, you know, use it for a cyber attack without nobody knowing because it's a machine. And this is, there are many different aspects. So this is definitely an issue that should be explored. There's no answers yet, but you just pinpoint to the right direction. This is a very growing vulnerability. And I would say this is part of why the United States have initiated the Clean Network Initiative in a way, saying to the world, if you use Chinese infrastructure, who knows, this vulnerability might grow. You know, you might be more vulnerable when entering this new phase of technology. By the way, I'm not saying this is true or not, because I don't think there are any technical evidence for that yet. But this is part of what they're saying. That's part of the rhetoric. And today, it's like we're rallying the camps around different standards, whether you'll be under, you know, the non-Chinese standard or the Chinese standard will be linked to how much would people not in your country be able to trust your infrastructure. And this has implication for economy, for you know, R&D, for many different stuff.
So a follow-up about the regional ecosystem. What will be the implications of this for the idea which you put forward of a regional ecosystem in places like the Middle East when you have a, you know, such a fragmented infrastructure?
Well, yeah, thanks for that. I mean, I think when saying a regional ecosystem, we can perceive this in different ways. We can see that as a very, you know, ideal view in which technology will enable countries that until now were in friction and were, you know, had conflictual interests to join hands. You know, and those, some of those views were portrayed in the 90s when the Oslo Accords took place and stuff like that. But also, it might have a much more practical meaning in terms that there are ecosystems connecting between governments, government entity, universities, but also private entities that are for profit. And we might see more connection, you know, for profit between states. This is, you know, it's much more low key, but also it should not be undermined because it has the potential to be the grain for much something much more bigger than that. You know, creating trust between the nations bottom up as opposed to top down. It sounds great, but, you know, the first, you know, in the close future, this might mean just, you know, commercial connections, but eventually this might lead to much more. And, you know, we should, you know, see, and hopefully this will lead to that and not to other stuff. It would surely enhance the complex dependency between states in the Middle East, which might decrease the, you know, the ability to escalate towards conflict.
Mm-hmm. We've actually come to the end, abruptly to the end of the time, but lots of very interesting things, threads of this, which we could follow up in the future. And I hope we will. Thank you very much for taking the time to share your thoughts on this very important topic and giving us something to mull over for the future. Best of luck and thank you again, Dr. Shina.
Thank you very much, Professor Eldon. I want to thank you personally and LSE IDs for your invitation. Thank you.
Our pleasure. Thank you. Bye.